this load up. Our first speaker is Chris Baker. Chris is a LEED accredited architect, engineer, and building modeling professional, and expert in web-based energy modeling tools at the White Group. All right, please welcome Chris.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to jump through the learning objectives and the AIA continuing ed. So my company is a 70-person energy efficiency practice, and we work on commercial new construction programs for utilities. So we do a lot of whole building energy modeling as part of that. And we also are part of a larger architecture and engineering firm with about 500 people. So I'm going to be presenting about how, over the past about 10 years, we've evolved how we approach pre-design energy modeling. And I just wanted to touch a little bit about what our context is. So we're working with a wide range of buildings as part of those utility programs. We are literally doing gas stations in Dubuque, Iowa, all the way up to hospitals. And we've tried to create an approach that works for that whole range of buildings. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. We also work on, within a design team when we are part of the firm that's doing the architecture and as third-party consultants. So any of us who have done energy modeling have all shown up to a meeting and they've asked, when can I have my answers? I need to make a decision in 3 days. Can you give me an answer? And we've been being asked that for a while. About 10 years ago, we started trying to figure out, okay, we're sick of having to demur and say, well, in 3 or 4 weeks we can have some numbers for you, and until then can we look at previous models. Our first two attempts at doing that were non-scalable, to say the least. The very first time was a 3-day energy modeling charrette, and the agreement we made with the architect was, if you gave me 3 different massing options by 5 p.m., by 9 a.m. the next morning, I will give you those energy results, and we can talk about which options make sense. That was a bad bargain to make with an architect. I didn't get the model. I didn't get their massing options till midnight, and I stayed up till 6 a.m. And then I had to present those results 3 hours later. Not a scalable solution. And so the next time we tried that, we talked about, okay, you give us the model, the information you want us to model. By Thursday afternoon, we'll have an answer for you by Monday or Tuesday. And that also wasn't a great experience. So we realized we had to get something more scalable, more repetitive, that didn't involve all-nighters. So that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today. The problem is we want modeling to inform the design, not just score it. And we all know that too often modeling is done after the major decisions are made, because that's when we know enough detail to do a good solid model. And modelers, we all want to be as accurate as we possibly can, but at some point we need to not worry. We need to be accurate, we need to be repeatable, but we also need to be able to provide information to inform the design. We are also seeing shorter and shorter design schedules with integrated project delivery. We are seeing owners setting higher and higher expectations for their architects and engineers. And as energy modelers, if we want to influence anything, we can't come back a week after they've made a decision or 2 weeks after drawings are done. We have to give information right then. And then, of course, more integrated design. As the code has progressed, if we want to go beyond code, we really have to be looking at a lot of different options early so that those options can be included in the design, not as an upcharge at the last minute, but just kind of baked into the design right from the beginning. So I drew this in Sharpie so that it would be nice and theoretical, but there's some trade-off between model uncertainty and model detail. And our natural inclination is we all want to be as far to the right there as possible. We all want to have a really detailed, accurate model. What we've been exploring is how much detail do we actually need to get information that's good enough to make a decision? Ultimately, we are asking owners to make financial investments in energy efficiency. If you could tell somebody what the price of a stock would be within 20% 5 years from now, it'd be pretty clear whether or not they should invest in that stock. If you could tell them within 5%, it'd be very clear. You don't need to know exactly in the early decision-making process. You just need to know relatively how much is this going to save versus my other options. That said, we then want to go on and refine that model as more information is available. So ultimately, there are three categories of inputs that go into the energy model. You have a physical design, you have operations, and you have weather. So we started to think, okay, what do we know about these different things? For the physical design, we work on commercial buildings. And the exact envelope, the exact shape of the building doesn't have a huge impact. And so for early design decision making, we've decided to use orientation neutral and a typical geometry for that building type and that size. We're using prototypical HVAC systems where you can pick from, at first it was about 8 different HVAC systems, now we're up to 75 different HVAC systems. We aren't letting you set the exact VAV box minimum setting, but we can get a good sense of which mechanical choices are going to have a large impact. For operations, we're using the 90.1 default schedules and also published modeling guidelines from other entities to set schedules and plug loads for all the different space uses. And then weather, we identify that based on the zip code for the project. As I mentioned earlier, we think of modeling as something that should be happening from the very beginning of a design, as soon as you know what kind of building you're going to build, let's build a model, all the way through the operations. And as that goes on, we try to refine and get more and more detailed models that are more and more accurate. But often what we're finding is they're just confirming the information we learned with that rough schematic, that pre-design energy model. Some of the other sources we used for information, we've set baselines by 90.1, 62 for ventilation, the AIA healthcare guide for medical ventilation, the Addenda BN schedules and loads. And then there were a couple of gaps that information we couldn't find. We data mined 2,000 projects that we had worked on previously through utility programs and extracted things like typical wall to floor area ratios for different building types of different size ranges. So the first attempt to do a scalable solution was essentially a glorified shoebox model. And we picked about 12 of the most common building types that we were working on, and we pre-ran models for 5 different climate zones, 7 different mechanical systems, and 60 to 80 strategies for each building type. And then we allowed design teams, so we have an image of it, this was, you know, spreadsheet, DOTU, macros, and basically bubblegum holding all of this together. And we would work with the design team, and we could allow them to select different options, and it would adjust the energy use, and we could see what the energy use by end use was. We had several different algorithms in there regulating so that if you had a bunch of lighting strategies, as you added more lighting strategies, there was less and less savings so that you could never save more than 80% of any given end use, or you could never save more than eliminating lighting completely. So we had a couple of things in the background that got at the interaction, but it was all pre-ran individual measures beyond code and then adding them up with algebra. And this was in about 2010. So to set this up, you would pick a location. You would pick a more detailed location for solar calculations. If anybody is with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in 2010, that was not a denial of service attack. We were trying to pull information from several different locations before we got blocked for where what the solar energy for different locations were. So we had written a little macro to ping the website with different locations, and that worked great for about half of them before they locked us out, and then we had to put a delay, so it was doing once an hour. But with that, we could say, okay, if you're in Minneapolis, this is what the renewable energy potential for a given solar array is versus Dubuque. And we had this all in a spreadsheet that we could walk into a charrette and start trading off options. Oh, and then you could see on the right, we showed for each of the building types, and it was about 12 originally, we'd show what the breakdown of space uses were. We have since started talking a lot about fidelity of models and whether fidelity being how accurate is the how precise of a representation of the building is the model. And what we found out in 2010, if you show architects the breakdown of space types, they start quibbling. No, no, we don't have 36% classroom, we have 32%. Okay, but we're going to get generally the same answer, and for this phase of design, that's reasonable enough. So with this first attempt, we used it on 131 projects in 2010 through 2013, so for over 3 years. What we found is projects that used pre-design energy modeling saved on average 45% beyond the code, compared to 30% on the projects that didn't. Now, I did not have the opportunity to do a double-blind study. I cannot, state that the pre-design energy modeling intervention is what caused all of that additional savings. There's some selection bias. Design teams that were interested in greater energy savings were the people participating in the pre-design energy modeling. But there's enough of a difference there that we started to think this is important. We should be doing this on more projects. As you might imagine, it quickly became very, very unwieldy to manage. We supported a single code at that point, 90.1/2007, and as states adopted newer codes, that was a problem to go back and try to update. As building types, we wanted to extend it to new building types, to areas beyond where we were providing most of our services. And every time we needed to update one of these, we basically needed to take a modeler who knew this spreadsheet system very intimately and took about a day to create a new building type. Now, that's a lot better than 2 weeks of modeling, but it was still really onerous. And what we were finding is about a 5 to 10% difference between this pre-design model and what the final energy savings percentage was. So if we thought it was 35% in the pre-design, it might be 40%, it might be 30% when we all was said and done. The design teams, they loved it. They wanted more. They wanted us to be able to handle more of the exceptions. Particularly, they wanted more mechanical systems. They did not like that we were constrained to kind of the 7 most typical mechanical systems. And they wanted to be able to assign different mechanical systems to different parts of the building. And then, of course, the space types never quite matched. So our second attempt was in 2013. And in our second attempt, we said, we're going to walk away from the space type thing. It's just a problem. People get into arguments. We're going to look at building types. And we're going to just model, you have a school, you have a laboratory building, you have a office building. But we also allowed it to support multiple mechanical systems. So 50 different mechanical systems. We built in a 2004, 7, and 10 code. We allowed you to model based on the building size. You could pick from 25 different building types. You would assign a number of floors. And then you could pick up to 3 different HVAC scenarios. Each HVAC scenario was assigning 1 mechanical system type to each of the different, here we are doing a whole building. So 1 mechanical system type per building, and then you could look at 3 different mechanical systems compared to each other. The new models were actually created during the SHRET then. So we would be in a meeting. This was our first web-based attempt at this. So in the meeting, as we make the combinations, it actually runs a new model on a server back at our office and pulls that information back down. So in that meeting, it's about 60 seconds to create a new option and run that new option, combination of measures. We got a lot more interest. It was a more flexible system. We got 165 projects in 2014. What we quickly found out, though, is building type was not granular enough. Somebody would come to us and say, I have a school addition. Great, we can do schools. Yeah, we're adding an auditorium to a building. Oh, our school model is mostly classrooms with some office and dining. So we realized we weren't thinking about the problem granular enough in our second attempt. In the first attempt, it was too granular. Second attempt, it wasn't granular enough. And we also realized darn near every building is pretty much a mixed-use building. That every building really is kind of its own special snowflake, and you needed to be able to reflect that and combine different building types. You know, when we had an office building, if it had 2% data center, that's very different than if it has 20% data center, for instance. So in 2015, we launched our third version of this. Here we're allowing people to pick building types and subtypes. So if they pick a university building, they then have a mix of subtypes, including classrooms, laboratory, offices. They can change the proportion of those subtypes, or they can add other subtypes. So if it's a university building with a retail component, you can have that in the model. Still based on location for the weather file, the local energy code for that state, utility rates, weather station. And then we have defaults that can be overridden. So we have default schedules, we have default ventilation rates, plug loads, and geometry. But if you know more about your building, we allow you to put that in. So later I'll be comparing this third version to when we do a full Appendix G model. Keep in mind that that comparison is with the default, so it would actually even narrow if we overrode those defaults. We then pull them into a model, and we're again sitting down with the architects, owners, and engineers and live in a meeting, updating that model and showing them what those results are, hopefully within that first week of design. We can compare three different HVAC scenarios. We now are supporting 75 mechanical system types. You select a heating plant, a cooling plant, a water area heat pump, the dedicated outside air system, and what the zone type is, and you mix those all together. The equipment is always auto-sized, so what we have found is as long as we use the same auto-sizing in both, we get a pretty accurate savings percentage. And we allow the engineers to compare these systems without having to design each one. Before we had this system, what we found when we would ask a mechanical engineer if they wanted to compare multiple mechanical systems, they didn't want to have to design into it with enough detail two, three, or four mechanical systems. By using this prototypical mechanical system comparison, we can very early on narrow down to one mechanical system type and progress that through design. And then later in design, when the owner says, well, what about ground source heat pump? Did you consider that? Yes, absolutely. And we can show the documentation and remind them that we had talked about that early in the design. So when we compare the mechanical systems, we show each one in KBTU per square foot and in dollar per square foot, and each one has its own unique baseline. Now, because we're working with utilities quite often, we have to make a few modifications to Appendix G to be fuel neutral. The utilities are very sensitive to fuel switching in their incentive program. So if, for instance, you have electric reheat, we're going to have electric terminal heat in the baseline rather than have it, if you had gas heat in the central, we wouldn't create a system that had gas in both. When we do this, what we find is some mechanical systems show very, very good savings because their baselines aren't so good. So for instance, a ground source heat pump, in some instances, doesn't save as much money as we thought as it does. If we model a ground source heat pump in this example, we have a VAV DX furnace with electric reheat, a VAV boiler in DX for the HVAC system 2, and a ground source heat pump with a dedicated outside air system. And if you look at this orange dot, is the baseline. So that baseline changes depending on what mechanical system you select. There are instances where the reason the ground source heat pump saves a bunch of energy is because the baseline is substantially more expensive to run. And so because of how the rule sets, that's what they get to take credit for. But we also want to talk to them about when they're comparing different mechanical systems, how much cost it's going to take to operate and how those costs compare with the different options. So we want to be able to let the owner look at it both ways. After we choose a mechanical system, we then show the results for individual measures. There's about 60 to 80 measures that we run for each of the different uses in the building, and we allow them to select those measures and create 3 to 9 bundles. So a bundle is a mix of measures on a given mechanical system design, and we show the cumulative results of those bundles compared to its own code up above. What's great about this is we get a lot of buy-in from the design team, so much so that what they decide to do at this point in design, during schematic or pre-design, 98% of the kWh and therm savings they decide on here end up in the final as-built building when we do a walkthrough of the building. Because they got to participate and they got to create these bundles themselves rather than just be told this is what you should do, we get a lot more realization factor. So on the 2015 version, this third version of ours, we've used it on 500 projects. 70% of those projects looked at multiple mechanical systems. The strategy results are available the same day as we set up the model, and those bundle results are available in that meeting as we're going through it. The new thing that teams are now asking us for is support for existing buildings, and so the next version we're going to have out is going to allow you to, rather than baselining to a energy code, you can define what your wall U-value is, what your roof U-value, and other existing building conditions are, and show what the savings to improve that. So that'll allow us to provide a more accurate savings number for existing buildings rather than comparing them just to the code. So lastly, I have a comparison of how accurate is this? Because ultimately, if we're not giving them a reasonably accurate number, doing the modeling earlier isn't all that helpful. So we compared, we took 5 buildings that we had done a 90.1 Appendix G model that had been reviewed and approved by a third-party green building labeling system. And we took those projects and we plugged them in using default schedules, default geometry, basically defaulting everything other than the strategies and the mix of building uses into this pre-design tool we've been using. So there's a couple of caveats I want to mention before we look at the comparison. The pre-design tool has a limited range of strategies. So for instance, when we look at lighting power density, we have a 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% savings. One of the projects had a 76 or so, 78% savings on site lighting. They had a very large parking area that they didn't use much light on, so we didn't quite capture that aspect. We're using standard schedules and ventilation rates, so there'd be a little bit of discrepancy there. And we're using a core and perimeter zoning rather than the project-specific zoning. So the blue is in the pre-design tool, and the red is with the full Appendix G model. There's a little bit of gap between these two, but if you're trying to make a decision on what to invest in, we were really happy with what this was, the savings. The other thing to note here is that there isn't an inherent over or under prediction bias. So we were within 3% on energy use intensity savings, so EUI. A couple of the buildings were a little more, a couple of buildings were a little less. Cost savings, the popular metric for Appendix G, obviously, we were within 0.5% on average, and again, a couple of the buildings were more, a couple of the buildings were less, but overall, a pretty good agreement. And, you know, again, making these decisions early on, we're within a couple of percent of each other on savings. So the benefits of being able to do this modeling very early. The owners can compare the savings for different choices and pick one that's effective and let the design team focus on that combination from early on. So instead of trying to carry multiple options over weeks of design, they can narrow it down and move forward decisively with one of them. Promising design features can be incorporated in the budget, in the schedule, right from the beginning. Perhaps even more valuable, strategies that aren't going to be that effective can be eliminated, and we don't have to continue to talk about them every meeting for the next 3 months. So lastly, I'm going to end with a quote from Andy Warhol. They always say times change things, but actually you have to change them yourself. We really want to see more modeling done earlier on more projects. And thank you, and opening for questions.
Very good presentation. Thank you. I have a few questions. Let me just rattle them off.
Okay.
Do you have any good modeling of data centers? And did you take total cost of ownership, that is, including the system first cost and maintenance other costs, into consideration, which is very important for us? The third thing, is this tool only used by in-house people? Is it available? Thank you.
Okay. We do have data centers. Most of the data centers we've used this tool on are data centers that are a component of another building. We have fewer data center specific strategies in the tool than, say, refrigerated retail. We have four or five refrigerated retail strategies. Data center, we have your typical mechanical systems, but we don't have data center specific. So if you had a million square foot data center, this might not be the right answer. If you have an office building with a data center, this would be a great answer. It is being used by people outside of our firm, but in situations where we're participating in a utility program, other design engineers are using the tool without us. We don't have a workflow available for third parties, just completely off on their own, but that's something we're interested in. Total life cycle cost. This is part of a suite of tools that's all built on the same platform. Several of those other tools do have total life cycle cost. This one does not, but we often will take these results and plug them into a total life cycle cost. The reason we don't have it on this one is getting default total cost of ownership on the mechanical systems. We don't have the great rules of thumb. I mean, the average cost of maintenance, even though it's not that big compared to the other factors, the best rule of thumb we can find is 2% of equipment first cost. It's not that granular there. So when we do a total life cycle cost, we try to have a little bit more in-depth discussion with a cost estimator and take about a week or so to do that, using this to generate the energy numbers and then plug it into another tool.
Two quick questions. First one was, what did you see as the advantage of developing something like this in-house as opposed to using one of the, there's certainly a few companies that are offering software that claim to do this kind of like pre-design SD level simulation?
A couple of advantages. We started working on utility programs before there were any graphic user interfaces, so our first utility program was 1993. And at that point, it was trying to get from a six-month modeling cycle to a six-week modeling cycle. And to do that, we started to build our own tools. And so by the time we decided to make this leap to pre-design, mm-hmm. it was just something that was part of our culture to be doing our own tools. We explored third-party tools, in 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. The workflows weren't ironed out enough. They seemed to be very focused on the architectural features and didn't really have the mechanical options available. Mm-hmm. The third-party tools have certainly gotten better. Mm-hmm. In the past 5 years, we have not found one that allows us to do so many options so quickly yet. Okay. Frankly, I'd love if we did, because then we would have a lot less, internal costs as a company.
Right, certainly. Yeah, certainly trying to develop like that is time consuming. So the other question, so it looked like that you guys are like an integrated, architectural in-house and engineering in-house. I guess, have you, I mean, have you used it? I mean, I guess, do you guys do work with other architecture firms? Have you used this with other outside firms? I guess I'm thinking, like, if you're a more of a MEP firm that doesn't have an in-house architectural, how that relationship is and
so
how that process works.
We use it on approximately 40 to 50 projects in-house per mm-hmm. year and 500 projects with other architects and engineers per year. So we use it a lot more outside as part of those utility programs where the utility we work on behalf of the utility to help the design teams figure out how to make the building more energy efficient. And then about 10% of the time we're working on projects that the broader AE firm that we're part of mm-hmm. is doing the design work on. So a little bit of both.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So thank you all.